Welcome to Ipsy Dixit, a podcast on legal scholarship. I'm your host, Brian L. Fry, Spears Gilbert Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky College of Law. My guest is Neosha Romer, Associate Professor of Law at Seton Hall Law School. We will discuss her draft article, Equity for American Indian Families. So welcome to the show, Neosha.
Hi, thanks for having me, Brian.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm really delighted to have you on to talk about this excellent and provocative new paper that you've written about the Indian Child Welfare Act and how we should think about it in a constitutional and policy context. For listeners who might not be familiar with the law, I wonder if you could say a little something about what the Indian Child Welfare Act or ICWA is, sort of when and why it was enacted, how it works, and sort of give them a little bit of historical context for why people are talking about it at the present moment.
Sure. So the Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted in 1978 by Congress. It is a piece of federal legislation that is applied in state courts across the country today. The Indian Child Welfare Act was passed primarily because of historical and contemporary issues impacting American Indian families and tribes. So by the mid-1970s, Congress found that approximately 25 to 35% of all American Indian children had been removed from their homes. And what this means, what they were looking at specifically, were the actions of federal. What they were looking at specifically were federal policies and the enactment of federal policies such as Indian boarding schools, the Indian Adoption Project, and they were also looking at the actions of state and private actors. So up until this time, there was a targeted assimilation program in which American Indian children were specifically targeted for removal from their parents, primarily because they were poor and they were Indian. I'm sure, you know, there are many folks who might, you know, say, hey, that can't be it. But if you look at the legislative histories and the testimony, and in fact, the senator, one of the main senators involved in passing this legislation, I'm going to butcher his name, but Senator Borzyk, I believe is his name, and an attorney for the Native American Rights Fund, Bertram Hirsch. They're both still alive today. And in this most recent ICWA case before the Supreme Court, submitted their own amicus briefs talking about what they observed in the 70s and why we still need this law today. And to sort of bring us to our contemporary moment, not only has this law been remedial, so healing those past harms, which we know are generational, but this law is also protecting Indian parents' rights in court today, and also making sure that tribes have the ability to maintain their membership, which was a huge problem and one of the reasons ICWA was passed. Because through this assimilation project, children were removed, ties were cut to their community, and that was one way in which the federal government could essentially, what we call in Indian law, terminate Indian tribes. So maybe a good way to think about this is cultural genocide. You know, one of the most famous or infamous, however you look at them, directors of a boarding school, an Indian boarding school, Colonel Richard Henry Pratt, is famous for saying, we need to kill the Indian to save the man, just meaning that, you know, we need to assimilate Indians but save the person. So this was a mission of sorts, to assimilate Indians into mainstream American culture, vis-a-vis the American Indian family.
Well, so as a kind of a practical legal matter, how does it work, and what does it do? Like, in other words, when ICWA was adopted, what specifically was it intended to change about the process by which Indian children were taken from one, their birth family, and placed with another family? Who did it affect and how, and what kind of additional processes did it add?
So So this is a really interesting question, Brian, because I think there's something that most scholars aren't aware of, and I think just in general the legal profession isn't aware of. Today we talk about child welfare law and in terms of it maybe being more like family regulation or family policing because of some of the standards and maybe some of the standards that aren't followed. And ICWA actually predates all of those laws. ICWA was enacted in 1978. The modern child welfare system, as we know it, the standards that are that Congress requires states to abide by, those didn't come into being until 1980. And so not only is ICWA providing a little bit more protection, and by that I mean heightened standards, heightened procedural standards for Indian parents, but it predates those procedural standards that exist in child welfare law for non-Indian families as well. On that particular note, in terms of ICWA sort of predating modern child welfare as we know it, there's two main things that I would focus on with ICWA, and I think these are the most important things. First, I'll talk about child welfare since I already started there. But ICWA applies to Indian children. It follows Indian children. I think that's really important. Something that we don't always talk about or don't really conceptualize in American law is this idea that it's the children who hold a status as an Indian person here, and that's what's important. So the statute will follow children, meaning that this particular these protections that I mentioned could be applied to an Indian parent or a non-Indian parent, because as we know, American Indians are one of the most racially diverse groups in America. So with that said, I mentioned these heightened protections, and we're really talking about things like making active efforts to keep the family together, requiring qualified expert witnesses who ideally are maybe members of the child's tribe and can speak to their cultural needs as well as what's going on in the home, before terminating parents' rights. And so really just providing these heightened protections for parents, making sure the best interests of the Indian child are met in these child welfare proceedings. And I think what ICWA is most known for is that in the event that a child must be removed from their home in these types of proceedings, enacting a placement preferences or a set of placement preferences that directs the court that absent good cause, you will, first off, you will be consulting with the tribe because in ICWA cases, the tribe may intervene at any point in the proceedings. So in child welfare proceedings, when ICWA applies and provides these heightened standards for parents and protects the best interests of the Indian child, it also incorporates the tribe as a stakeholder in these proceedings. Because as I mentioned before, one of the reasons that Congress had to act in the 70s was to ensure that American Indian children weren't continuously removed from their communities in wholesale numbers, to make sure their communities could continue to exist. Because imagine, the more children you remove, the more children you remove, eventually you don't have a tribe. And that's basically what was going on. So that's the child welfare side of things. And actually, the placement preferences, I think, is one of the things that people know most about ICWA. In child welfare matters, the statute directs the state court, absent good cause to the contrary, you will first look to the child's family. That is major. Because that's not statutorily required in every state. And I always ask my students about this. Do you think that in a removal proceeding that a state court would have to place the children with the family? And most people say yes, like that's how it should work. And I ask, do you think they always go to the family? And yes, they do. But that's just not the case, for a variety of reasons that we see in both ICWA and non-ICWA contexts. So with that being said, that's how those placement preferences work. As part of the statute, we start with the family, other tribal members, and so on and so forth. And the second context that I would mention here, which is adoption, what we see or what we hear the most, I think, is that ICWA somehow interrupts or disrupts a parent's right or birth parent's right to place their child for adoption or to choose adoptive parents. And, you know, that's something that I really counter that narrative and try to counter that narrative. And I encourage people to think differently, which is why, you know, I wrote one reason I wrote this paper. Because realistically, one reason ICWL was passed was to make sure that Indian parents or the parents of Indian children were able to have voluntary and knowing consent to place their children for adoption. Because we were talking about an era where people who maybe didn't speak English, and if they did, maybe weren't literate, were handed blank sheets of paper and told, just sign here. Or would maybe reach out to have someone babysit, and the babysitter would drop the child off at an orphanage. And this was all okay. This was all perfectly legal stuff. So to take advantage of that way and you know, terminating a parent's rights without them really understanding what was going on. So on the adoption side of things, that's the number one thing that ICWA does, is it really tries to make sure that the parent, the birth parent, understands their rights and what they are doing. The other thing is an emphasis on, again, those placement preferences, keeping the child with their family first and within the tribe second, and then so on and so forth. Realistically, although ICWA is applied most often in the child welfare context, the adoption context is where we see the most strife, the most litigation. In the recent Holland versus Brackeen case that was before the Supreme Court, you know, one of those cases, the Brackeen family, their case actually started as a child welfare case in which they were fostering a child whose parents' rights were then terminated, and the child was ineligible for adoption. So it went from the child welfare to the adoption side of things fairly quickly. Well, I shouldn't say fairly quickly, but it did transition, which is not abnormal in these types of cases. And ICWA was then challenged. That was the challenge, was, you know, because this family who didn't meet the placement preference criteria, you know, wasn't able to adopt under the statute. Or, you know, that's what the statute said. And, you know, their tribe had a different placement. And, you know, the last thing that I would kind of emphasize here, because I feel like I focused a lot on the family aspect of ICWA, is the tribal involvement piece, and ensuring that tribes are able to be involved in directing what happens to the mem their member children, be it in child welfare, be it in adoption. You know, ICWA vests tribes with the right to intervene in state court proceedings. Tribes can request transfer to tribal court, meaning that, you know, the case that started in state court may be able to go to tribal court and be resolved there, which even that's controversial. And I think some of that is because of prejudice or maybe stereotypes about what tribal courts are and what they do. But, you know, ICWA is very popular among social workers for a reason. And one of those reasons being the resources that communities offer their own members. The ability to, you know, get these cases off the state docket and off the backs of state social workers. And also the ability to connect children with their family and their culture, which we understand as best practices in child welfare.
Well, so just really quickly, for the sake of sort of like helping me better understand how the law applies in practice, how does ICWA determine which children it applies to and which children it doesn't apply to? And when parties can intervene and provide information or affect the removal or placement of a child, who's allowed to do that? Is it like any tribe or a particular tribe? Who's actually implicated by the statute in question?
So one reason I wrote this particular article is that who question. Who does ICWA apply to? You know, for I think a lot of us, federal Indian law turns this incredibly important question in American society on its head about race and what does race mean? Because ICWA, through its statutory definition of Indian child, requires that the child be under 18, unmarried, so hence still a child. But there's also this third prong. And this third prong is directly tied to the child's membership in a tribe. Or their, how I would phrase this, immediate access or eligibility for membership in the tribe. So we're not necessarily talking about, for lack of a better term, box checkers. We're talking about children who have a political connection to a specific tribe, or who, and this is what usually happens through the course of the proceedings, because these proceedings, they take months, sometimes years, can become enrolled in a tribe. And so the federal standard is ICWA applies when there is reason to know that the child is an Indian child under ICWA's statutory definition. And again, I would highlight that political status component. We're not merely talking about people who, might say, "Hey, I believe I'm Native American." There has to be that membership piece. And in terms of your question about which tribes can intervene and how does that work, it's the Indian child's tribe. So the tribe in which that child has membership in, or in which they're eligible for that membership. And in terms of when they can intervene, it's at any point during the proceeding. And I think this is another thing that makes ICWA a little bit unique. It's one of the only statutes I know of, and I'm sure there are more statutes than I can comprehend, so that's not necessarily definitive, but it is one of the only statutes I know of in which a party can intervene for the first time on appeal. Because what sometimes happens is that, particularly on the child welfare side of things, ICWA requires that the state or the moving party, so whoever is adverse to the parents' rights, notify the child's tribe to let the tribe know these proceedings are going on, essentially letting them know, "Hey, you have a child here in these proceedings, and if you want to participate, please come on." And we often see that doesn't happen. And so when that doesn't happen, you might see a tribe intervening for the first time on appeal, because maybe that's the first time they even, received that notice or found out this case was going on.
So, as you mentioned in the paper extensively, there's been considerable litigation over ICWA, especially in recent years. And in fact, there was a pretty recent big Supreme Court case addressing ICWA and its application and its constitutionality in different respects. Could you say a little something about sort of what the objections to it were, why those objections were rejected, and sort of what potential looming problems or questions there are still remaining that might kind of become salient in the near future?
Yes, so in Holland versus Rakeen, we saw a mix of individual and state parties challenging the constitutionality of ICWA on three major grounds. So the first ground was Congress's Article I authority to enact ICWA. So where does this authority come from, essentially, for Congress to pass this law involving child welfare, which is deeply funny on a couple of levels, because as I mentioned, and maybe not in the greatest detail, Congress is currently the reason that some states even have abuse and neglect laws, let alone the procedural standards we have. Because Congress, in the 70s and 80s told states, "Hey, here's what you're going to do if you want to get some funding from us," right? Using their spending power. Unfortunately, ICWA fell outside of that spending power, but Congress's specific authority to pass ICWA is the trust responsibility that Congress owes to Indian tribes. So I think what sometimes gets lost in the weeds about ICWA is that it is family law, definitely family law, but it's also a tool of federal Indian policy. It's federal Indian law. And so I think that kind of gets lost in the weeds sometimes. So that was the first challenge, was Congress's Article I authority to enact ICWA. And there, the Supreme Court rejected that particular argument, And I mean, the way that they reject it is in the way that I think it's a definitive rejection, but I would be committing malpractice if I didn't say that I think there's long been, and it's, or not that I think, there has been a very long attack on federal Indian law and policy, particularly from the legal right, in terms of seeing federal Indian law as a, you know, bundle of specialized rights. And so on that side of things, there are still definitely folks utilizing that assimilation language, you know, saying we don't need federal Indian law. In fact, Justice Thomas, you know, has actually called it so-called federal Indian law, you know, indicating that he doesn't believe there is a constitutional root, or constitutional basis rather, for this particular body of law. But as I mentioned, the Supreme Court, the majority, which, by the way, the majority in this case was 7-2, if that tells you anything, in our current fractured court system, 7-2 majority says that, you know, ICWA is not unconstitutional on the grounds that this is an abuse of Congress's Article I authority. The second argument was an anti-commandeering argument. Again, kind of funny because Congress tells states all the time what to do with child welfare. But sort of the crux of this argument here is that it comment that ICWA commandeers state law by making states do things. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument primarily on the basis of ICWA applies to both state parties and private parties the same way. A good example of this, I mentioned child welfare cases. But another class of cases in which you might see ICWA used is if you have one parent trying to terminate the rights of the second parent. This is a common scenario for what we call step-parent adoption. If that child is an Indian child, ICWA applies to that termination of parental rights, meaning that parent who's trying to terminate those rights, they are responsible for fulfilling those duties under ICWA. So it applies to state and private actors alike. As I mentioned, SCOTUS rejected that argument. And then finally, the third challenge, which is the crux of my paper, the meat of my paper, if you will, was the equal protection challenge. Essentially, the claim here was that ICWA is a race-based law for two main reasons. The first reason is the definition of Indian child. So, who counts as an Indian child? The claim there was that Indian is ancestry based, so it's a proxy for race. And the second thing being that the placement preferences for the Indian Child Welfare Act, the third placement preference allows for placement with a family who's a tribal member, but maybe not necessarily a member of that tribe, of that child's tribe. So challenging that that's a race-based preference. The court and the majority doesn't really reject the argument. They dismiss it on the grounds of standing, being that the parties didn't really have standing to bring the issue. Now, with that particular part of the opinion, what is interesting is sort of how the court almost directs the parties on how they could bring that up. And Justice Kavanaugh writes a concurring opinion, citing to Palmore versus Sadati, which is a 1970s case, I believe, about race discrimination in child custody. So, you know, he's basically saying, hey, I think we do need to revisit this when we have standing. I don't agree that there's, you know, that it's not necessarily an equal protection violation. But those were the three major challenges. And as I mentioned, this paper really digs into the equal protection part. The reason being is, first off, I really wanted to address the legal community on this particular issue of what does Indian child even mean? There's a huge body of scholarship in federal Indian law that has not only just been anticipating this type of challenge, but responsive. Because one of what, like I said, one of the long arguments against federal Indian law is that it's providing special rights to Indian people or to Indian tribes. And as I think we all saw with Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard, and that entire line of affirmative action cases before it, we don't like special rights. We don't like anything that reeks of, affirmative action type things. So ICWA's opponents have long tried to treat ICWA like it is affirmative action. And to treat it that way, to define it that way, so that it essentially is ruled unconstitutional. So I focused on the equal protection piece here to really describe the political part of this. And also, I think in the modern era, we're kind of at a crossroads here in terms of political and racial, and what does that mean? Because while there is definitely a legal difference, what we see happening and what we've seen happening since the 19th century, when the government got involved with Indian families, removing Indian children, it really is racism. It is racism. But any of these laws that Congress passes through its trust responsibility to federally recognize Indian tribes is through its constitutionally recognized trust responsibility to those tribes.
Well, so have you seen any evidence that some of the parties who were objecting to ICWA in this recent case are sort of teeing up new cases on equal protection type grounds? And if they do that, what kinds of arguments would you anticipate them to try to make to argue that there's a problem with ICWA? And how would you respond to those kinds of equal protection complaints in sort of a kind of more granular, like on the ground way?
So, to my knowledge, Brian, I'm not sure that there has been any movement yet, but I don't get the sense that this is the last of it. ICWA's opponents, particularly one attorney who has long been a very vocal ICWA opponent, even on his social media, was talking about how this isn't the end of it after this decision was released. So I foresee them coming. I foresee very similar arguments being made. And something I would highlight, earlier when I mentioned that this is racism, I misspoke a bit, because although it is racism, what we're really talking about is colonialism. We're looking at this through the lens of the settler colonial power, which in the US has often incorporated racism. But we have to acknowledge what that means for tribal governments who are sovereign. And that's what settler colonialism does. But in terms of the arguments, what I find very troubling is that the plaintiffs in this case, I believe Justice Kavanaugh's concurring opinion, and Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard, all cite to one case that, I'll go ahead and talk about it a little bit, and I think this kind of describes the inherent problem with this particular line of thought. They all rely on this case called Rice v. Cayetano. It's a 2000, year 2000, Supreme Court case. It's actually a Voting Rights Act case under the 15th Amendment. But it's discussing the rights of Native Hawaiians and whether or not a statute in Hawaii can basically say, we have an office, but only Native Hawaiians, as we define it in the statute, can vote for this office. And that law is challenged. And in that particular case, SCOTUS says, from what we can tell, Congress doesn't have any special relationship with Native Hawaiians. Therefore, this is not political. It looks more like ancestry, which is a proxy for race. So therefore, this is race-based. Therefore, the 15th Amendment, very strict, more strict than the 14th Amendment, says that this law is unconstitutional, or this act is unconstitutional. That's what they were relying on. Their argument, the opponent or the plaintiff's argument in Brad Keene, really was, this is just like this case in which the Supreme Court looked at the history of Hawaii, looked at, the state's reasoning for having such a law, and really said, this is race, not political status. And the whole reason, right, that we're talking about here is this colonialism and how we have traditionally understood who, which political groups are protected and which aren't. So I find that interesting that that case is also cited in Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard as ancestry, being a proxy for race and sort of how they're relying on that. Because realistically, I mean, ancestry is a proxy for me being American. I'm American because I was born to two American parents in the United States, right? That's how we confer citizenship. And so it's a little troubling how that particular line of thought is or is being used. And so I think that exact argument will probably come right back around. Because from what I could tell in the opinion, it really was just being dismissed on standing grounds, not reaching the merits. So I could see the same arguments being brought again.
So, reading your paper, one of the things that was really interesting to me is that it sounded like a lot of the objections to ICWA sounded in this idea that the only consideration in a child removal or placement case should be the best interests of the child. But ultimately, that's always going to be decided by a political actor. And so what I felt kind of puzzling about it is tribes are political actors. They're independent sovereigns. What I don't understand about this argument that people are making is why wouldn't Indian tribes be every bit as capable of assessing the best interests of the child as any other political body?
I think you're hitting on a real tension in terms of why there is opposition to ICWA. And when I say tension, actually, this is one of the most common questions I'm asked. What about the best interests of the children? In fact, I remember posting once on Twitter about ICWA, and I had somebody with a PhD, an academic, in my mentions saying ICWA denies the best interest hearing for Indian children. And it's not that ICWA denies the best interest hearing, but two things here. First, what you touched upon. Getting the tribes involved is protecting the Indian child's best interest because the tribes don't come in, to a state court proceeding and, lay down the law, so to speak. They don't, right? They come in and they act as any other party would. They make recommendations. They assess the case. Well, I said that a little backwards, but they assess the case. They, see what's going on and make their recommendations, just like the state. Just like the parent's attorney. And if there's a guardian ad litem for the children, that attorney as well, or that person as well. So they are coming in and doing that and assessing what's going on. If the case happens to get transferred to tribal court, tribal law applies. Many tribes have their own statutes or codes for determining a child's best interests. So it's not that ICWA is completely denying the child's best interests. What ICWA is doing is saying we have an Indian child. They have a unique set of best interests that it's best that we not only hear from the state, that we hear from their parent and see what's going on with the parent and what they're doing and their attorney, but also the tribe. And so that's what's going on with ICWA and the best interest there. The second thing that I would highlight comes from more of a family law perspective, which is I think we have and not just me thinking this. There's a body of scholarship on this. I know particularly Josh Gupta Kagan, excuse me. I know particularly that Josh Gupta Kagan writes about this. But we have a misplaced trust in state statutory best interest standards because all it is a list of factors that the court should consider in their determinations, right? That's all it is. But we have this misplaced trust in it that, if we have this hearing where we hear evidence about these different things, that will definitely ensure the child's best interests are met. But what we're finding with those particular hearings is they are often void of any sort of cultural context, the same sort of one-sidedness that you would imagine you would get without the hearing still exists. And they don't frankly, they don't often rely on what the kids want or what's going on with the actual children. It is a third party adult looking at what's happening in the case and assessing those factors. So I think we have a misplaced trust in that process altogether, which is a little bit outside of my article. And I know I address it there, but I do think that's something that we need to be mindful of, is that, being that ICWA cases are taking place in state court, some of these same issues with family regulation, family policing, child welfare that we see in other cases are also happening in ICWA cases.
So in your paper, you're pretty critical of the way that kind of equal protection language is deployed in ICWA cases as a way of trying to limit the ability of Indian tribes to intervene in the cases, make recommendations, and have a role in the placement of the children, a kind of attack on the kind of tribal sovereignty in those circumstances. Do you think that that's representative of a broader move to use equal protection language in that way, or is it more limited to the ICWA context? Like, to what extent do you think this is representative of a kind of broader way of thinking about the role of tribes and tribal sovereignty?
I think there is some broader move. Again, this ties back to special rights and this idea of special rights. There is actually a case ongoing right now called Wes Flagler v. Florida. It's a gaming case out of Florida. And sort of the crux of that case is, or one of the issues there, rather, is equal protection. And whether the state of Florida's compact with this particular tribe violates equal protection. Right. And so I think this is often tied to economics, especially economics, because, I think it's fascinating that some of the same folks who are constantly talking about the best interests of Indian children are also tying it to economic arguments, such as, the right kind of families, which, it's economics plus race plus class, but the right kind of families. The families who can provide for them, the families who really want them. Lots of commentary about how poor reservations might be. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that, private adoptions run somewhere in the ballpark of $30,000 a piece, right? So while the opponents, and listen, I don't want to characterize their motives in any way because I can't know their motives. But I think it's fascinating that at the same time they're making arguments that, ICWA denies the best interests of Indian children and keeps them from the people that really love them, which is a problem in and of itself. They're also making these economic-based arguments, right? Or somehow protecting this industry or being protective of an industry that, again, charges, and I mean, $30,000, that's pre-inflation numbers. I don't know what they are right now, but private adoptions are very expensive, and they're lucrative for those who handle them. I think that's one of the interesting tensions there.
Well, so in closing, Nosha, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you see coming down the road on these questions. Are you hopeful that the Supreme Court is going to stay on the side of tribal sovereignty and push back against these kinds of equal protection arguments, or are you worried that there might be some risk of them weakening or in some way, making ICWA harder for tribes to use and making it more difficult for them to effectively intervene?
So I will say that I'm hopeful, and it's not because of the Supreme Court. I'm hopeful because while the Brad King litigation was happening, a variety of states, I believe we're up to 11 now, 11 states, either already had or enacted its own version, its own state version of ICWA. And what I think is so important about that is that we know state court judges are more likely to apply state law before they are federal law. We've seen this happen where, state court judges are like, that doesn't apply here. But if it's a state law, they know it applies there. It shows support, right, within state legislatures for this law. As I mentioned before, social workers tend to be supportive of this law. So the people who are on the ground every day are supportive of this law. So that, again, right there, that's a lot of hope for me. Because do I know what the Supreme Court's going to do with that? I mean, we saw in Dobbs that, they don't really seem to care about popular support or, anything like that if they believe that it's not constitutionally valid. But I think the more that we educate people on what the act is, what it does, breaking down some of these myths, which I don't do in this paper with myths, but I do have another article called Unerasing American Indians from Family Law, in which I talk about these myths. But erasing these myths and really helping people understand what the law is. So educating not only legal professionals like ourselves, but also educating the general public. There was a report a couple years ago called Reclaiming Native Truth. And in that report, what this group found was that once people became educated about American Indian issues, tribal sovereignty, what they first perceived as special rights, maybe not being special rights, maybe just, something that was owed as a responsibility, they changed how they viewed laws. And, I think Brakeen is really the first major case where the media coverage was equal parts, right? I think we had a lot of positive, pro-ICWA media coverage, and we still had not so positive ICWA coverage. But just 10 years ago, when Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl was up at the Supreme Court, the media was absolutely brutal to the tribal position and to the Indian Child Welfare Act. There's a notorious episode of Dr. Phil where he just sort of tears into the tribal attorney for the Cherokee Nation. And I mean, it's just so horrible. And those were the messages. But now, because I think that there is, more mainstream support, American Indians are, not that they've not always been here and talking and telling us, and we've not been listening, frankly. But you have American Indian journalists such as Rebecca Nagel and her podcast, This Land, American Indian law professors like Matthew Fletcher, Winona Singel. I'm going to stop listing. This is not meant to be a slight to anyone, but there's so many American Indian law professors and professors who are out there, and they're more visible now than I think in 2013. Again, not by their own doing, but because of how frankly, we've always erased American Indians from American culture, right? It's an interesting statistic I wasn't aware of, is that most schools don't talk about Native Americans post 1900, right? So we don't talk about these issues and don't talk about the communities in a way that makes them visible. So I think as we continue to educate, to demonstrate what ICWA is doing, to talk about how ICWA demonstrates some of the best practices. It demonstrates how child welfare can be, right? If we have the right actors involved, if we have the right sort of standards. Again, like I mentioned, it's not perfect. Even Justice Gorsuch, who wrote a beautiful concurring opinion in Brakeen, mentions that ICWA is not a panacea. It doesn't fix everything, right? It's still has some of those same issues that non-ICWA cases have in the child welfare system. We still see some of those same issues. But, I think that as we educate and show how ICWA demonstrates those best practices, I think that it's a model for moving forward. I know some of my colleagues are arguing, for stronger abolitionist policies. But I do think that sort of in my line of work, having worked with tribal courts and been on that side of things, that when you have communities involved, and I think this is the important part, when you have communities involved in children's lives and these making these types of decisions that, quite frankly, are traumatic for kids and their parents, the outcomes tend to be better. And so I know this has been a long-winded wrap up, but I would just continue to emphasize these best practices, and what's going on with community support. And that's where my hope comes from, because I frankly don't know what the Supreme Court will do if this issue is brought back. Because to me, it seems like it could go the way of it is unconstitutional. Not because I believe that to be true. As I mentioned, I believe that ICWA is based on political status. It is a duty. It was enacted under, Congress's trust responsibility to tribes. But in terms of whether the court believes that, and doesn't lean towards, oh, it's race, it's affirmative action, I can't say that to be true. And what's really devastating about that, Brian, is if that happens, that could be the death knell for all of federal Indian law, because the entire Title 25 of the US Code, it's really based on the fact that Indians are, or that, Indian is a political status, that tribes are sovereign. So I don't know what that would mean. So that's the dangerousness of this particular line of thinking. So I wish I could be more hopeful that and say that yes, it'll be constitutional, because I sincerely believe it is. I just don't know what this court will do.
Well, I share your hope, and I look forward to seeing your paper in its final form. Thanks so much for coming on the show to talk about it today. It was a real pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Cavalcade of America, presented by DuPont. Although the Constitution of the United States has been the foundation of our country since 1787, few of us realize why or how it came into being. Let us turn back the hands of the clock to the year 1784. It is market day in the city of New York. A fleet of boats loaded with livestock, vegetables, fruits, and dairy products has sailed from the New Jersey shore of the Hudson towards the city. On one of these sailing vessels, Hobbs, a New Jersey farmer, is talking with his son George as their craft pulls ahead of the others.